This podcast brought to you by the English Department at Florida State University.
Here is what you really need to know about Chris Jensen. He is my space baby. It has basically been scientifically proven that Chris Jensen is my future son who has come back in time to make sure that I'm doing okay and will find my way to falling in love with his space dad. How did we figure this out, you might ask? It might have been the third or fourth time we met eyes across the room when some awkward moment made us both want to scurry off and die. It may have been when we both took a ridiculous online quiz that revealed we were both INFJ personality types, which correlated significantly to us being wolves or perhaps badgers. It might be because we are solitary and ornery like those animals. In short, the similarities just seem too uncanny for this to not be true. But listen, mostly, I like to think of Chris Jensen as my space baby, because Chris is so awesome that this is totally flattering to me. Chris is thorough and committed in his scholarship of medievalism, but he is also the sort of guy who will look up from his research and say, did you know that in the journals of Marjorie Kemp, she is basically writing gospel fan fiction, that she is writing a buddy comedy between herself and Jesus? Chris Jensen has the kind of voice that any choir would be lucky to have, but he uses his talents to sing T.I. Coldplay mashups on the ukulele. He is the sort of person who claims he will definitely not get a pet, but then he finds what could be a cat or could be a feral werebadger in a heap of sticks beneath his apartment and not only adopts it, but bottle feeds it back to health. Chris Jensen is the kind of guy who will drive all the way to Atlanta with you for a Todd Seabrook book launch, and not only will he not complain when you suggest that Michael Jackson's Will You Be There from the Free Willy soundtrack is the perfect musical accompaniment, but when you play it 30 more times, he will have learned all of the harmonies and the woo-woos so he can sing along with you. And this kind of wisdom and nostalgia and humor is what a Chris Jensen essay is all about. Chris's writing looks backward to understand today. He remembers the strangeness of the past and instead of shrugging it off asks, hey, what was that about? He reminds us that we were weird even when we were kids and that we aren't nearly so different and grown up now as we like to pretend we are. He wants you to laugh and weep at the same time because he is a jerk and because this is what writers do. Of Chris Jensen, Tom Bevilacqua once said, Chris Jensen writes like the child of C.S. Lewis and Sufjan Stevens, especially if that child liked to take pictures of a small, vaguely feral cat. Chris, once upon dominating Tom in Trivial Pursuit, shouted, ha ha, fuck you, Tom, which was the most aggressive I've ever seen Chris Jensen be. Chris Jensen is also a PhD student in medieval literature from West Palm Beach, Florida. He is also my favorite employee at the Bookshelf Bookstore in Thomasville, Georgia, for whom he also writes a monthly column. And you should nominate him for a holiday bonus from James Patterson, the author. Yes, that James Patterson. Ask me for details on how you can do this later. I've been touting him as a kind of bookstore genius, Jesus to everyone. So make sure you vote for him as well. Also, he has presented scholarly work at several international conferences and has served as a nonfiction reader for the Southeast Review. He has published several poems and short stories in the alumni magazine at Palm Beach Atlantic University. So please welcome Chris Jensen.
CJ Hauser is my space mom. I time traveled from the future to tell you that. Tom and I did not plan to both read essays that have a lot to do with the themes of fall and Halloween, but hey, we did. So thank you for coming out tonight. Thank you to people who organized this, and I'm going to read for you an essay titled Mirrors in the Dark. In grad school, I had a roommate who loved This American Life. The wonderful thing about people who love This American Life is that they can relate any conversation back to a specific episode. And they almost invariably do so in the same way. Actually, there's a great This American Life about that. It's always a great This American Life. There's no other adjective for it. Anyway, there's a great This American Life about camp that originally aired in 1998, in which Ira Glass follows 12 10-year-old boys into a small bathroom in order to record them chanting a particular name into a mirror, all of them hoping to see a bloody face and feel the weight of a spectral dead baby in their arms. My roommate, one weekend, was on our porch listening to this episode while I was working on the floor at the coffee table inside. The sliding glass door separating the porch from the living room was closed, so even though I could hear voices coming from his computer, I couldn't make out what they were saying. until the chanting began. Rhythmically, louder and louder, prepubescent voices shouted from my porch, and I started to panic. I stood up, knocking over an empty glass, and stumbled to the sliding door where I said, "I need you to turn this off, now!" My roommate looked up at me for a second, confused, and then started laughing hysterically because he remembered. He remembered that I was a 23-year-old man who was utterly fucking terrified of Bloody Mary. I'm 25 now. I have a master's degree. I voted in 2 presidential elections. I have a cat and framed artwork in my apartment. And I think saying that name just now is the first time I've said it out loud in 10 years. I wince when people order the cocktail at brunch, which is to say I've obviously never ordered one. I generally won't even spell it out. In my notes for this very essay, she appears only as BM, as she will continue to do for the rest of the evening. The name itself has become a personal taboo. I dare not speak it, lest I incur the wrath of the dreaded BM. As an aside, I would like to point out that my aforementioned roommate often forgot this shorthand, and whenever BM came up, as she weirdly often did in the 2 years we lived together, it would take him a second to register the fact that the thing I'm afraid of in the bathroom is not, in fact, a bowel movement. I'm not a particularly superstitious person, really. As a child, I used to intentionally walk under ladders and open umbrellas inside to prove that. I have a healthy fascination with the occult, like anyone who grew up on Harry Potter and Miss Cleo infomercials did. So sure, I occasionally read tarot cards, which I understand is not something that a not particularly superstitious person, really, is likely to say. When I do, it's to look at myself and my subconscious associations like a Rorschach test, not to ask the spirits to tell me my future. I've turned the supernatural into psychology. But BM sticks with me, gnawing at the back of my mind just about any time I walk into a bathroom to this day. The very phrase, mirror in the dark, is enough to slightly elevate my heart rate even though I don't actually think anything will happen. I'm not a believer. I rationally know that chanting and spinning and whatever else is involved will not summon a spirit into the reflective glass that hangs in the room where I poop. Yet, I'm haunted by the same question that nags at the heart of all writers. What if? That's the point, more or less, of the children's game, isn't it? It's about the power of suggestion. In the This American Life piece, nothing happens when the kids finish chanting. They debate the number of times they were supposed to say her name, 40 or 50, and start to question each other as to who messed it up when finally one of the kids claims to feel the weight of a dead baby in his arms, and the groupthink takes over. Another kid claims to feel it too, and they all lose their minds. But BM isn't even the scariest or weirdest supernatural thing that I've come across in my life. In my freshman year of college, I became acquainted with a girl named Brittany, who claimed that she could see and talk to angels and demons. Because I went to a Christian liberal arts college, this was different, but not unheard of. Most people who knew about it believed her, because they had no reason not to. Like the kids in the bathroom, all it took was one person to affirm what she said, and she was held up as some sort of afflicted prophet. There were gargoyle creatures everywhere, she said, especially in the Third World, where they had more influence. People in the West had wealth, and thus didn't need as much demonic activity to turn them away from God. Demons always knew when she was around, and would come and taunt her. When she was a little girl, she said, one came to her in the guise of her own body, hanging from a noose in her bedroom. She covered her eyes and told it to go away, but it kept calling out to her in her own voice, "Come play with me! Come play with me!" She told me these stories, and they terrified and thrilled me. They were patently unbelievable in the most literal sense of the word, but her conviction was such that I couldn't help but listen, and I wasn't alone. We were young and fervent faithful, and this was an affirmation of our faith in the world unseen. When I told my mom, a nurse and devout Protestant, about Brittany and her visions, she told me to help her find a psychiatrist. But Brittany called me one night and asked me to come with her to an upperclassman house party off campus because there was a girl there who claimed to see angels. Brittany wanted to see if she was legitimate to affirm or condemn her supposed second sight. We waited outside by the fire pit for hours until everyone left the party except for us and this girl. Even the hosts had gone to bed. The three of us sat there in silence around the dying embers until finally the other girl said, "I know who you are. They told me you were coming." What ensued didn't make a lot of sense to me, but I knew that I wanted to leave. I was overcome by a heavy sense of dread, and all I could really do was bear witness to two young women say things about one another that they really shouldn't have known. When I finally got home, well into the wee hours, I threw up. And that was scary and strange and weirdly inexplicable, but it wasn't like what I still experience with BM. Maybe it does weirdly have its root in bathrooms. In the early 90s, Nickelodeon had a show about summer camp called Salute Your Shorts. Whoop whoop if you remember. In one episode, the campers tell one another a ghost story about a phantasm called Zeke the Plumber. A veteran of the Korean War, Zeke lost his nose in combat and was thus unable to smell the gas leak that took his life. His ghost haunts the bathrooms of Camp Anawana, and I distinctly remember a dream sequence in which he attacks one of the campers with a plunger in his bunk. Before I even knew about BM, Zeke the Plumber lingered behind every shower curtain with a flannel shirt and bloody bandage across his face. Once I learned about BM in second grade, she joined him in my anxious nightmares with wild hair, a steely knife, and empty, bleeding eye sockets. The difference between Zeke and BM, though, is that I grew out of my fear of Zeke sometime in middle school, whereas, at 25, I am still so afraid of the very idea of BM that I won't pronounce her name on stage in a crowded public place. In college, I invented a ghost story for our century-old apartment building. Wooden Lucy was an employee of the old hotel that became our residence who hanged herself in the bathroom of one of our first-floor apartments. No one found her body for several weeks, and she was eventually quietly buried on the property to prevent a scandal. The 40-foot banyan tree in our courtyard, in my telling, grew from the gravesite. And if you looked closely into some of the upper branches, you could still make out the shape of a warped human torso, which is true. The bathroom ghost is so ingrained in my imagination from childhood that I created an entire such mythology for our building, maybe in a half-hearted attempt at exorcism. In any case, the legend of Wooden Lucy spread so far around campus that I was approached by a reporter for the school paper who didn't know I had made it up, to give an interview about what it was like to live in a supposedly haunted building. What I really think my primal fear comes from, though, is mirrors. BM has her origins in catoptromancy, that is, divining the future through looking into dimly lit mirrors. In early instances, she's called Hell Mary or Mary Worth, and is often depicted as a witch. Chant her name into a mirror, and she'll appear to answer three questions for you, or tell you the name of your true love. Over the years, this evolved into the modern folklore in which she is summoned as a ghost or a corpse who screams and screams and visits you with blood. Or maybe she cries about her lost baby. The iterations, even the ones I learned in elementary school, are many and varied. They always involve a dark room, a mirror, and chanting her name. The first version I knew included spinning around and saying her name three times, at which point the mirror would become cracked and streaked with blood. As more and more kids would sneak off to the bathroom at lunch to try it, the legend grew and grew until there was a headless man in the bathroom stall, a stump of his neck pouring blood onto the floor, a crying baby that nobody could find, and the woman herself, who came out of the mirror once to scratch up Zach Bailey's arms, evidently with a red pen. One of the explanations bandied about for the enduring popularity of this legend is the Troxler effect, which accounts for the brain's evolutionary need to signify. It's like the opposite of what happens when you say the same word over and over again until it doesn't make sense anymore. Giraffe. 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 If you stare at nothing for long enough, your brain will create something for you to see. You can try this at home. No chanting required. Look at a fixed point in your mirror for a few minutes, preferably in low light conditions. Report back with what you see, because I'm obviously not going to do this myself. But I do get really close sometimes, because I'm achingly curious about what my brain will produce. It's like my Rorschach test with the tarot cards. I pay attention to what the various images conjure in my mind to better figure out what's bothering me about a given situation. I understand that I'm the one creating the meaning. It's me. It's controlled. Everything I read in the cards is an aspect of myself that I'm projecting onto the given images of the cards. What scares me about the mirror technique is that I don't know what I'm going to see. I have no idea what my truly unconscious aspect is going to create, and as curious as I am, I also never want to see that. Some mysteries were never meant to be explored. Maybe what's so viscerally horrifying to me about BM is precisely the idea that I will look into a mirror and see something that is not me. Lacan theorized that human children around the age of 18 months enter what he called the mirror stage, at which they recognize their reflections as themselves. It's an important marker in identity formation, in that the individual subject is able to identify itself as an object, simultaneously a process of alienation and self-discovery. What I see when I look into a mirror is thus supposed to represent me. If, at 18 months, I saw a bloody-faced mirror ghost, maybe my identity would have formed around that. And I would now be screaming at you and scratching your eyes out instead of publicly reading weird personal essays. But I have an established and mostly stable identity now, which is why I have no interest in seeing anything in the mirror except the remarkably lifelike Tim Burton stop-motion doll that I generally call Chris. Because I've been not me before, and let me tell you, it is a strange and disorienting experience. Indulge me once again while I divulge another bizarre private detail about my life. I have never had a sex dream in which I was a participant. Let me clarify. In any and every sex dream I've ever had, I've either been watching the proceedings as a voyeur, or, if I was engaged in the act, I was another person. Surely some psychiatrist has gotten tenure from my neurosis. Some examples, though, since I've been told this isn't an easy thing for most people to comprehend. The earliest one I can recall involved me as Danny Bonaducci from the Partridge Family going to town on an Ewok while I watched myself in the mirror, again, as Danny Bonaducci. Another time, I was Tracy Morgan from SNL on 30 Rock with a Latino dude, just hand stuff. Still another time, I was Scott Adsit, also from 30 Rock, with a morbidly obese woman who was also his mother in a bathtub. According to the dream log I've been keeping for the past 5 years, I have had dream sex with and as almost the entire cast of 30 Rock. When I told this to my college roommate Connor, his reaction was horror with a twist of academic interest. How are you not yourself in your own dream? That's a really deep-seated kind of dissociation. He later got really into handwriting analysis and told me I have sociopathic tendencies because I break my line in the middle of my last name. He's in a cult now. But every time it happens, whether I'm Tracy Morgan or a washed-up 70s child star, I wake up and think, what the fuck? I have to pat myself all over to make sure I'm still me, the one I see when I look into the mirror. What haunts me to this day about Britney's story of the demon in her bedroom is that it presented itself to her in her own image. She could look at it and see her own face, but it wasn't her face. Hear her own voice, but it wasn't her voice. The reflection in the mirror is supposed to be me. So what reaction other than visceral horror can one possibly have to looking into the mirror and encountering something else? Something other. Since I moved to Tallahassee, there has been a mirror in my bedroom. When I went to pick out furniture, the salesman was insistent that I have a mirror attached to my dresser. It's a good piece! You're gonna want it! It was my first experience with a furniture retailer, and I was not adequately prepared to tell him no. But I was dreading going home and installing the mirror and waiting for night to fall. The bathroom was one thing, but how could I ever get to sleep with a dark mirror just feet from my bed? For 3.5 years, the only thing that has kept me sane at night is to avoid looking where my face is supposed to be in the mirror. I rationally know that it's just a reflection of me, maybe slightly distorted by the darkness and my own poor eyesight. But what if? What if it's something else? Thank you.